Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Grounded. I'm your host, Piper, and I've got my co-host, Gunnar, with me as well. We'd like to welcome a very special guest today, Landon Oldham with Heartland Soul Services. Welcome, Landon.
Thanks a lot, Piper. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. How was your 4th of July weekend? Anything special?
Oh, yeah, it was busy, you know, go, go, go. We relaxed. We went down to the lake and hung out with friends, you know, shot off fireworks, stayed up too late, made a few bad decisions, and here we are back into the normal world, you know?
We were talking with a few members of your team earlier today about fireworks, and I was remiss because I'm in New York, and they don't let you shoot off fireworks on the 4th of July anymore.
Oh, no.
It's a bummer. They give you special days of the month that your towns can shoot them off. So July 20th, we'll get our 4th of July celebration then.
July 20th. Well, at least you'll get to celebrate.
At least we'll get it, yeah. Yeah, good deal. So, Landon, we've got you here today to talk a little bit about Heartland. You've done, I've actually listened to your podcast, both Gunnar and I have. You've built a pretty impressive business here over the last, two decades? So, we'd love to learn a little bit about it and dig into the history of Heartland.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Piper. Yeah, we did. We just started a podcast in the row, which, you know, it's just new and taking off, but it starts out documenting where we came from, and so I'll kind of cruise through a little bit of that. I'm in South Central Kansas, a little bitty town called Cunningham. Just think about Mayberry. It is Andy Griffith Central. We don't have any stoplights. There's still primarily dirt roads. You know, and I knew growing up here that this is where I wanted to raise my kids. I went to Kansas State University, graduated in agricultural business. While I was working at K-State, I was working for a local farmer as well as working at the local Orscheln Farm and Home. And then I also took on a third job, which became my primary job. It was for a company, a small company out of Missouri, Nevada, Missouri, called Record Harvest. You know, we were selling GPS guidance systems. And I was turning wrenches on combines, sprayers, applicators, you name it, swathers. And what it wound up being was, you know, at that point in time, that was – well, when I started there, it was probably 2007, I suppose. Well, 2005. I worked 2 years in college. And then these farmers were starting to get up and up on the technology. You know, at that point in time, the technology was built on third party. And it left a lot to be had, I felt. These guys were buying it primarily to drive back and forth. And ultimately, that equipment and that technology was capable of so much more, and even more so today. And what they were missing was the information necessary to utilize that equipment. And so that's kind of where Heartland Soil Services, at that point was soil sampling, stemmed from. Came home one day, my wife was 8 months pregnant with our very first child. We lived in a house that was new to us, my first house. It cost me $15,000, that house did. That's unheard of now. We were living there, living a meager life. You know, it was working. We had good jobs. She worked at a High Plains Farm Credit, an ag bank. And I came home one day and I said, "Hey, I've got an idea." I said, "All this equipment that I'm selling and installing, I said, I think I can make it do a lot more than it already is." And she said, "Yeah." I pitched it to her, and she said, "Yeah, that sounds like it'd work." I said, "Well, I hope it does, because I quit my job today." And that was in 2009. And at that point, realistically, we had just bought a new to us house. We had bought a new house. We were in the process of moving out, and I quit my job. So that was a make it or break it point, you know?
As someone who has been 8 months pregnant 3 times and has also bought a new to us house, I can say you're lucky to have a wife after that. She must have a lot of trust and faith in you.
The words out of her mouth were, "Are you kidding me?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, I hope it works." I said, "Me too." And so fast forward to today, we've got just under 40 employees. We're covering multiple states across the entire United States, working very closely with Earth Optics in a lot of these different regions. That's been a wonderful relationship, of which I intend on expanding with. You know, so we currently cover Kansas, Colorado, Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska. That's kind of our core. I opened up a new location in South Dakota, allowing us to work in South Dakota, Minnesota. We've got a a partner. I've kind of been chasing this little bit of a franchise type model. I don't want to call it a franchise. But we've got a new partner in Montana as well. And so, yeah, it's really exploded for us, and we've been very fortunate.
We've worked with you a lot as a soil sampling provider, as a service provider, subcontractor. There's many flavors of that term, and most importantly, as a partner on so many of our projects. Today, I was looking over it. I don't have the statistic, but it was countless. I mean, we got at least 20 projects under our belt together. What else does Heartland do? Because I know you do so much more, and you offer so much more than just soil sampling.
So yeah, we do our bread and butter began around soil sampling and nutrient availability and precision, and allowing growers to know exactly what they have, where they have it, and what they need and where they need it. But we're working with some irrigation technology companies to help conserve water, water a little bit more efficiently and effectively. I know, as everybody's well aware, the Ogallala Aquifer, which is our primary groundwater source, is depleting at a rapid rate. And if we continue along that same path, it's going to be non-existent, and that's going to dry up a lot of these small communities like Cunningham. And so, you know, we work a lot with the irrigation technology. We run a lot of data analysis, so yield data, planting data, yield by hybrid and variety, yield by soil type, you know, run those analysis. Realistically, in the data side of things, some of these companies out here, My John Deere or John Deere with their collection tools as well as Climate, they own the data collection process, and I see them as furthering that, and they can have it. I don't want to chase data. The what I'm working towards is how am I going to utilize that data? Because even though they are good at collecting it, good at presenting it, it still needs to be made actionable. And so that's kind of become our goal. You know, we've for a long time chased thumb drives, and you get combines that got hit by lightning or anything like that. And so it makes the data collection process a little bit testing, to say the least. So we're starting to help implement that data, help utilize that data, help these farmers become more efficient on the farm, in the field. Of recent, about 4 years ago, maybe five now, I had an opportunity, I saw an opportunity to implement some NRCS type services in-house. So we have our own NRCS technical service providers, TSPs, certified in-house. We have two of them. We're working on a third one as we speak. And ultimately what that allows us to do is it allows us to take all of the opportunities and all of, you know, vet our growers and vet the subsidies that the NRCS offers to our growers to change their practices to more regenerative, sustainable, whatever buzzword you want to use at this point in time. Mm-hmm. Practices, you know, they offer monies to plant cover crops, to help afford cover crops, to go to no-till, to implement variable rate. And so at that point in time, I was approached by the state agronomist of Kansas, and he said, hey, listen, we're duplicating your efforts. You already have this information. You already have this data. If you would just become a certified technical service provider for the NRCS, you could sign off on this, and we would eliminate that duplication. I said, yeah, that makes sense. I went to class. I started going back to school, a place I never thought I'd be, but it was a little bit different terms. And that's where I met our current farm comp. That department's called Farm Comp. That's where I met our current farm comp manager, Noah Goza. We were sitting in class together and got to talking. I told him why I was there, what I was doing. And he kind of looks at me and he says, I'm certified for all of that. And I said, are you kidding me? And he said, no. And I looked at him right there and I said, do you want a job? And I kind of just gave him a brief overview of what was going through my head at that point in time. And he said, yeah, that sounds amazing. And I said, are you serious? And he says, yeah. I shook his hand and he shook mine. And I got up in the middle of class. I threw my books in the trash and I never looked back. And so we pomp and we manage a lot of acres. They're certified in multiple states. That's been a really good deal, and it's a great experience for our customers as well.
So you talked about how you just brought Noah on. Can you tell me, let's go back to the beginning. You started this with your wife while she's 8 months pregnant, and she looks at you and she says, I don't know exactly. Am I allowed to say curse words on this podcast? I'm not sure. But she says, are you kidding me? We'll leave the expletives out. Where did you go from there? And we don't have to dive deep into all of it. Listeners, for what it's worth, Landon's In the Row podcast is an awesome history into his business, and I definitely recommend listening to it. But Landon, give us the kind of brief timeline from there.
So at that point, I just I figured, like I said, it was a make it or break it. It was going to work or it wasn't. So I went, and of course, I didn't have any money to speak of. I went to the bank. I got a loan for a $3,000 used four-wheeler. Had to have a co-signer for that at the time, and, you know, got that all taken care of. And then I had a really good friend. His name's Shane Steinmates. He's since passed away. But he had a local independent fertilizer company, and he had a lot of the technology that I needed somebody to have to utilize the information I wanted to provide based on grid soil sampling and variable rate fertility. He had all the variable rate technology. And so I approached Shane and I said, "Hey Shane, I'm wanting to get, here's what I'm doing." I pitched him my idea. I said, "Would you prepay me for 5,000 acres of grid soil sampling? And then I'll service this and I'll get you paid back as quickly as possible." And you know, that guy, no contract, no anything. He didn't bat an eye. He said, "Absolutely." And I gave it to him at a discounted rate, and he said, "How much do you need?" And I said, $32,250, I believe it was somewhere in there. I'm sure I change it every time I tell the story, but it was right around $32,000. And he stroked a check and slid it across the desk and said, "Let's get going." And that was kind of where it started. I started driving up and down roads. I'd get up in the mornings before daylight, and I'd try and catch guys getting their tractors around. I printed up some pretty meager business cards. Tried to be smart with the money that I had based on what Shane had just lent me. And I just started driving back and forth. Out here in Kansas, our roads are on a grid pattern. So every square mile, you're going to run into another road. I just started running a grid. And every time I saw a tractor, I'd throw a business card on the floor. Every time I saw somebody standing in the farmyard, I'd introduce myself. And that's kind of where it started, you know. Things started picking up. We lived on beans for a while. I was running solo. A little bit later, who is now our COO, Mark Vierthaler, within a year came on. He had just graduated agronomy at Kansas State University. And so he came on. That was actually a pretty good story in itself there. He had called me, and he was writing a paper for one of his classes, and he wanted to interview Heartland Soil Services. And I was like, "Well, yeah, sure, you know." And at the end of the interview, I asked him, I said, "Mark, when you graduate, do you want a job?" And he's like, "Well, I don't know." So right as soon as he graduated, I didn't have quite enough work to justify both of our existence. And so he was working some construction on the side. And pretty soon things started to ramp up, and we were tag teaming things in a little, well, in my house at first. And, you know, I got tired of running the vacuum, bringing all that soil in every day. And my wife's dining room table was always cluttered with soil samples, and she was less than impressed, I guess you could say, but she was still helping. She'd sort samples. And finally, at some point, Mark and I decided we needed to build a shop. So we built a shop and had a little 10x10 office in that shop. Had one desk. We shared each of us had a side of that desk, and we went at it. And then we started finding some guys that were interested in being field technicians and some friends. And, you know, it's been an amazing ride, because a lot of the employees that we have been cherry picked from the farm, or they've found us. We put out very few help wanted ads. And what's so awesome about our team is most of them are farm raised kids, and yeah, they've got that work ethic. They know how to do what they need to do. And realistically, they have the opportunity to wear both hats and see both sides of the story, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and as someone who's worked with you, Landon, I know firsthand that when you say you value your field technicians, you mean that you value your field technicians.
100%. Yeah. You know, I view it as a totem pole, and I think as a society, our society is entirely backwards in its thought process as to who's the most important on that totem pole. The guy at the top is important, don't get me wrong. He's the one setting everything up, getting it all done, taking care of stuff. But that guy on the bottom is far more important than the guy on the top, because if you kick that guy off the bottom of that totem pole, that thing's going to fall down, and that guy on the top is going to be looking for a job too.
Yeah. So my last kind of question on the history of Heartland, what problems did you face? And you've touched on this a little bit with, you know, trying to do more with the technology that people already had in their hands. But what problems did you face, and what problems did you want to solve when you first set out on the road?
the first problems you face is you're bringing something to the table that most of these guys had never seen nor heard of. It wasn't very widespread. And let's be real, farmers are good at what they do. They always have been, and they're nimble. They can shake when they need to shake and move when they need to move. And they've been doing what they've been doing for the last 50 years, decades. And to come in there, it was sometimes a hard approach because you really had to be careful about how you went about that conversation to make sure that they didn't come across, it didn't come across as though you were downplaying what they're doing and saying, and that they perceive it as they're doing it wrong, because they're not. They were doing the best they had with what they had. And so it was more of an educational opportunity than it was a sales opportunity. And if they would give you the opportunity to sit down and explain yourself, which sometimes that was hard to come by too, just because times, we don't get any more time, and it seems to be less and less that we have to spare. And so, to educate them, hey, I'm not changing your practices. What I'm doing is I'm targeting your equipment. You've already spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on this equipment that's capable of far more than you're utilizing it for. Let me help you put it to use and use it appropriately. Once they get going on that, and then they give you the opportunity, I never will ask for the farm. Don't give me every acre, because in their mind, when you come to them with a six, seven, eight, ten, $12 an acre service, if they're a $1,000 farm or a 1,000 acre farm, they're saying that's 12 grand. I don't have 12 grand. Hey, I only want 100 acres. Give me 80 acres. Let me prove myself. Let me try this. Once you got done with that very first field, and it stands true to this day, and you sat down with that grower, and when they'd ask me, do I do my best field, my worst field? My answer was always, do the field you farmed the longest, the one you know like the back of your hand, because that map that we all provide them that shows the nutrient availability, fertility, whatever it might show, their yield map, for instance, that map's in their head. They have more knowledge of that farm than any data set we can provide them. It's just how do we make it actionable? And so that was the premise. Let me do 80 acres. Okay, sure. So we'd get the results back. I'd go pull the grid soil samples. I'd always liked a 2.5 acre grid sample. It kind of was a good spot for the economics, because economics are still a driving force, and they've got to be justified. But also the agronomics. I like the 2.5 for the agronomics. I'd love to go to a smaller grid size. But in doing that, because I get more agronomically viable data, but the economics are too far outside of most of these guys' budgets to be able to afford it at that point until they really saw. Anyways, I'd go pull the samples. I'd get back the results. I'd make the maps. I'd sit down with the growers, have a consultation, which we still do to this day. I mean, who likes to go get an MRI and the doctor hands you the results, and it's like, what am I looking at, right? So we sit
That's a
down
great
with every
analogy.
single one. I mean, it's the reality of it. You put a soil sample analysis in front of a grower, and they're looking at it like you just handed them a foreign language. A lot of them, not all of them, they're very knowledgeable in a lot of this, and they're becoming more so. But still, it's just a bunch of numbers, and they're saying, "What do I do with it?" So the consultation is extraordinary. But when we would sit down with these growers, the aha moment in the beginning that said, "This is really going to work," was at that consultation when I start opening up these books and I'm going through each individual nutrient and explaining that nutrient's role in the plant, explaining all of this and all of that. And they may be listening, they may not be, but they're looking at that map and they're saying, that area right there that I've identified, that hasn't done anything for years. Well, it's an area that's got a pH of, 4.8. Your nutrients are tied up. This area over here, it's always been a heck of an area. It's always outproduced everything. And so then you start having that conversation, or you get to those fields where you've got this anomaly in the middle, and I can't figure out what the anomaly is. It's like nothing makes sense. It's extremely high in sodium or whatever it might be. And then you put it down in front of that customer, in front of that grower, and he'll say, "Oh yeah, there used to be an old oil well disposal sitting there."
They
That's and so
always know.
they can
Always.
explain the why, And so at that point, and then being able to produce that map and say, okay, let's say it was low pH. They'd applied lime. One of the conversations I had with a grower at one point was, he said, "Well, I've put lime on in the past." And he said, "It didn't do anything. That's lime." And I said, "Well, how much did you put on?" "Well, we put on 2 ton to every acre." Okay. We got his grid samples back. His average was actually about 3 ton to the acre that he needed. So therefore, in the areas that needed more, 4 or 5 ton, he didn't put enough on to even tip the scale. And then the areas that didn't need anything, he probably compounded those issues by flat rating that nutrient or that lime, that product across every single acre. And so then to sit down with him and say, yeah, you still do need lime. Here's how lime works, and here's exactly where you need it by how much. That's kind of when you could see the light bulb go off on these guys'
Yeah,
thought
now
process.
let's go back a step here because you've mentioned a few things, and that's a perfect segue into our next topic, which is soil sampling. But so you've mentioned that, you know, the overarching goal of what you're doing is not just collecting data and providing data, but it's really putting it to use, and it's putting it to use in an economical sense that makes sense for the farmer and their operation, and that keeps you in business. Let's be real. Now you were talking about soil sampling from a grid perspective there. You know, you mentioned like a 2.5 acre grid. Can you kind of break down what grid sampling is and how that, you know, differs from the historical kind of composite sampling? You know, we hear this all the time. Can you just kind of explain the differences and why one is maybe preferred over the other and why, you know, you do what you do and others what do what they do?
Yeah, so I'll just start with a composite soil sample. A lot of guys have pulled their own soil samples over the course of their career on the farm. You know, a composite soil sample. We still pull quite a few of them just because guys are looking again back to the economics, thinking they can't afford it. But ultimately, a composite soil sample, I don't like to see composite soil samples represent more than about 80 acres. So on an 80-acre composite soil samples, you'd go out there and you'd zigzag your way across the field or run a pattern, whatever it might be. You pull 20, 30, 40 cores to your specified depth, and you throw them all into a plastic bucket. A clean plastic bucket, not the bucket you just dumped all the transmission fluid out of your tractor in, you know.
Fair.
And so a clean bucket, and you blend them up, you homogenize that soil sample, and then once you homogenize that soil sample, you scoop out enough of that to fill a pop can or a soda can, whatever you want to call it, wherever you're from. And then you send that soil sample to the laboratory. And the laboratory wants no more than that soda can full, because they've got so much soil coming in anyways, and that the overburden associated with that is tremendous. Anyways, you send it to the laboratory. At that point, the laboratory is going to get it, and they're going to dry it down. They're going to go through their processes. They'll further homogenize that soil so it's a much even more even blend. And then they're going to remove a single teaspoon, so just say the size of your pinky fingernail, out of that soda can or that bag of soil, and that's what's going to run the analysis. So now all of a sudden, if you think about it, you just took 80 acres worth of soil, reduced it to a 5 gallon bucket, reduced it to a soda can, and reduced that again to a teaspoon to represent the hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fertility you're going to put on that field. And a lot of times what guys would do is they would use that one field. They might have 3 or 4 or 5 fields around, and they may blend samples. They may just sample one field and say, well, this field needed 100 pounds of ABC 123, so I'm just going to do it for the rest of them. You know, and so that's such a small representation of such a large area. So then you get into the grid soil sampling, you know, and a lot of guys do zone soil sampling, that, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that either. Just identifying zones. Maybe it's per soil type, maybe it's per yield data, maybe, you know, who knows what they're determining their zones based off of. But the grid soil sampling, what I've always liked about that is it's repeatable. And I think that the repeatability is as much as important as anything in the process, because I don't need to come back and realistically for and re-pull those soil samples for about 3, 4 years. And I want to be able to try and replicate and repeat that same soil sample as closely as I possibly can. Now, obviously, I can't repeat that same soil sample. I already sent that soil down the road. But at the end of the day, what we'll do is we'll go out there and we will drive our boundaries. So it's a driven boundary with a corrected GPS system. And the reason we drive our boundaries is because we've had digitized boundaries. It's not hard. Everybody does it. Sits around and you can click on a mouse and draw out a field boundary. One experience, it took me one experience, and educations are expensive, and we're always paying for one. I'll say that. But one experience of somebody sent me their own field boundary and said, hey, just use this boundary. They thought they were going to cheapen up the service. And then they get into corn planting, and we had written a variable rate seeding recommendation, and their planter wouldn't come within 50 feet of the true boundary. And that's just, even though on the computer screen it looked like that boundary was exactly where it was supposed to be, it wasn't. And so we drive all of our boundaries. At that point, we'll lay out a uniform grid sampling pattern. So like I said, I like to do it every 2.5 acres. We'll try and adjust that pattern so that we get as many soil samples as we possibly can within that boundary. And then we'll draw out our navigational pattern. So how we're going to travel this field. We'll stop on every single soil sample site at the very center of that grid cell. And this is where it can be controversial for some as well. I have chosen, and what we've always stuck to, is you park on the center of that grid cell, drop your pin, and then walk about, say, a 20 to 30 yard radius around center point. We'll pull, say, 10 to 12 cores at a specified depth. A lot of times that's right around that 6-inch depth, realistically. 10 to 12 cores within that 30 yard radius, just walk that circle, and then blend all of that soil. We do not blend and discard. The laboratory will then homogenize that. So there's no plastic pail. We're not going out there pulling as many samples as we can from that 2.5 acre grid cell and blending them and then extracting what we need. We're keeping every single bit of soil that we collect, and then we'll send it off to the laboratory for the same dry down sample analysis process. On a 2.5 acre grid, on 160 acres, you know, there's going to be about 64 soil sample sites. You know, you do the math on that. So we'll put that soil core in the ground for about 768 times. And we'll send those results off. What I was getting at as far as sampling within the grid cell is there's a couple of different ways and methods. And I'm not saying they're wrong. They're just not what I chose, that others have done. Some will wander all over the grid cell. And what they're trying to capture is they're trying to capture the variability within that grid cell, thinking they're going to have a more accurate representation of that grid cell. But that's hard to repeat. That is very hard to repeat. Then you've got others that, for the sake of time, you know, because we get paid by the acre, and so do most of the field technicians that service these acres for other companies as well in a lot of fashion. They'll just stop on center point, and they'll pull all four corners of their four-wheeler, and they'll keep those cores. For one, I don't think that's enough cores to have an accurate representation. For two, it's very repeatable. So if you're chasing repeatability and variability, you captured repeatability in that aspect. Sure. But I don't think it's enough soil cores to accurately represent that. So that's where we decided to park on, or I decided in the very beginning to park on center and walk that 20 to 30 yard radius so that I can try and capture the best of both worlds, repeatability and variability.
That's awesome. So yeah, Yeah, super, super tough. And that grid approach really is to just, you know, create a greater resolution map, you know, making something more actionable for the farmer. Let's not assume this, you know, quarter section to be all the same, because that's just silly. Let's face it. Let's look at it, you know, 2.5 acre by 2.5 acre, even acre by acre. Now that's got to be a lot more expensive to service, you know, on your end. So that's a lot more expensive for the farmer to pay for. Now, of course, there's an ROI involved with you're actually managing your land much more appropriately and much more responsibly. So what's that conversation been like with growers to, you know, kind of convince them that, look, this is a much more expensive path to take, but it's going to be much, much better for your operation itself?
You know, really, as growers became educated and they saw what I was trying to express to them, that's not a very hard conversation any longer. In the beginning, it definitely was, to your point. But at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're creating efficiencies on the farm and potential increase of yield, because now we've got the right amount of product in the right location. Not only that, it's also more environmentally friendly, for the fact that we're not putting product where we don't need product, causing all the green algae blooms that we get blamed for and all of the, you know, the climate issues that we're experiencing. So, you know, once growers experienced that, and I would come back to them with our product recommendations. And I'll be honest with you, Gunnar, sometimes I'm calling for more product than they've ever applied, than they traditionally applied. Mm-hmm. But the caveat to that is look at the yield potential. Look at the increased yield potential we now have, because now through data and through science, we know that if you're chasing, say, 60, 70 bushel wheat, you've only been putting enough enough input out there for 30 bushel wheat. And so, you know, they'd see that and then they'd see the yield increase. A lot of, we get call after call. I've got numerous text messages from growers that enter yield contests and they send us thank yous that we're a huge, tremendous part of them having accomplished what they accomplish. And, but at the end of the day, when they get done with harvest and they see the field, and like I said, they've all got that mental image in their head of what that field looks like, be it wheat, corn, whatever, and where the better and lesser producing areas are. And they're out there sitting in that combine, whether the yield monitor's telling them anything or not, or whether they even have it on, doesn't matter, because the visual aesthetics of what they see throughout the growing season and at harvest confirms everything that we had discussed on the front side. And we've got success story after success story in that same regard. You come back and, like I say, that 3 to 4 year time frame. One of the educational items there was everybody wanted to look and they wanted to compare number for number. So they wanted to say, oh, well, I had 27 parts per million phosphorus in this region last year, and now I've only got 23. Well, you know, it's not a matter of comparing number for number, because again, I can't recreate that same soil sample that I already sent off, but it's a matter of comparing the regions, the zones that we portrayed. Did this region come up or go down, you know? And based upon how aggressive they wanted to be, we can go into a build program that says, hey, over the course of 4 years, we're going to build these fertility levels from 12 parts per million FOS to 24 parts per million FOS. That's a very aggressive approach and it's very expensive. Or do they go into a maintenance program or a build maintain, or do you extend that build from a 4 year time frame to an 8 year time frame to kind of drag that out? Because realistically, the issues that a lot of these guys are facing aren't issues we're going to fix in a single year's time or even in a 4 year time, because they've been issues that have been created from the course of the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think you really hit the nail on the head there. Especially talking about the intersection between, running a profitable farm, but also soil health. Something I think a lot about, I was in Virginia the other week for a precision ag conference that I gave a really brief talk at. And, you know, the overarching theme was just that there's no soil health without profitability and vice versa. You're spending all this equipment or all this money on equipment, on, you know, service providers to give you data. And it's really about managing your farm efficiently, but there's always the secondhand benefit of soil health. And oftentimes that's judged by the carbon concentration in your soil. And Landon, I know that's been a big growing part of your business, is sampling for carbon. We've talked a bit about agronomic sampling or sampling for fertility management. Could you tell us a bit about how your company's grown with respect to carbon?
Yeah, there's been a tremendous opportunity for us in the company and chasing the climate play, not just carbon, but soil regenerative practices, sustainability practices. And realistically, as a society, people want to know where their food comes from. We want to know that what we're eating is grown, is grown safely, and that it's healthy, and so everything that we're working towards is definitely high on my list of priorities in that regard. But the carbon has been the biggest play so far, because there's a lot of opportunities out there for growers. We just did a podcast on carbon as well, and we're going to do a follow-up one tomorrow, and it's very opportunistic. I think it's not going to go away. I think it lacks standardization in the industry, because every single entity out there has their own process and procedure that need these acres serviced in this fashion. And most of them are very different than the other one, you know? And so mm-hmm. I think standardization is going to be key. Piper, you've experienced that as well. I know in working with you over the course, every time we have a conversation, there's a different standard and different protocol. And, you know, it still comes back to economics. You know, a lot of the sampling processes that we perform are very labor intensive and they're very widespread. And so in that, there's a lot of additional expenses associated with travel and overhead. There's a lot of expenses associated with the fact that, how do I incentivize a guy to go leave home, maybe a wife and kids, maybe not, but leave home for 2, 3, 4 weeks at a time and go service these acres. And it all comes back down to the economics, the money, and the money's got to go back to those field technicians, making sure that it's worth their time to miss the time that they're going to miss.
Mm-hmm.
Landon, it's not just expense and overhead and travel. It's also equipment. I mean, I think you and I go back and forth every week, multiple times a week on this equipment, that equipment. We got to swap and swap and ship. And, you know, it's every protocol has a different equipment spec, and we're trying to keep up most of the time, it feels like.
They do. And that equipment's not cheap either, as you're well aware, you know.
This
one takes another $5,000 probe, and we need three of them. Oh, good grief, you know. But – you know, the reality of it is, and that kind of leads into a new company that I've started and I've been working on with Earth Optics a little bit as Netco, and creating this network of service providers that I've got a lot of connections across the United States, and I've already got a lot of these connections in place. So how can we cheapen that service up? How can we make it to where the services are provided in a more timely manner versus us trying to travel all across states, so that we can get those services done? Because in row crop, we've also got a timeline associated with that we've got to get it done. You know, right now there's a lot of standing crops, and we've got a very short window to cover a ton of acres in the middle. And so in this network in Netco, I've vetted and found a lot of service providers that are across the entire United States, and I'm still finding more and vetting more. Mm-hmm. So that when, you know, to the and I don't know, like the Walmarts of the world who are trying to, you know, become carbon neutral, when they're trying to purchase carbon credits from a grower and they have 600,000 acres across the United States, it's hard for one company to cover all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in this network of service providers, and I can go out there and I can get a pin drop map showing where all of these acres are located. And then I can access the network and delegate those acres to the network and say, hey, there's very little, if any, travel associated with these 20, 30, 40,000 acres, because they're right in your backyard. Get a bid, bring those bids back to the table, average them out, and then go back to the company. You know, you created timeliness. You created a convenience play. Hopefully we've cheapened it up, because now we've eliminated a lot of the overhead we just spoke of. And the additionality to that convenience play is now Walmart has one connection. You know, they're not, those service providers are already vetted and serviced and sourced, and they get their acres covered. And they're covered timely. They're covered mm-hmm. in a timely fashion. So that's been one of the big constraints in the carbon.
Yeah, I know something that I spend a lot of time thinking about is how exciting but also frightening it is how much demand there is for soil carbon quantification. And I don't know if there's necessarily a lack of supply, but it's like, oh my God, is it difficult to cover 180,000 acres in 1 month? And then, you know, in 5 years, I got to be back there and do the same exact thing within, you know, plus or minus 2 weeks. Like I spent 8 months as a field technician for Earth Optics, and I had the pleasure of doing a bunch of fertility sampling and a bunch of sampling on these carbon credit projects. And Piper was actually the program manager for the first carbon project I got to go to, which is now infamously known throughout the company, and it was a wonderful learning experience. But no, Landon, when I was listening to your episode on carbon, I swear my head almost exploded when you started talking about how much pride you take in your field technicians and how laborious the job is, because they truly are the unsung heroes out there, as far as they're out there just sweating, bleeding, crying, whatever, to get all these carbon samples for us, because it is intense terrain, especially on these grass and rangeland projects. You know, obviously the row crop's a little bit nicer. But no, it is really laborious work. It's really expensive to go out there and service it. Like you said, Landon, we're juggling protocols and equipment all the time. And yeah, I completely agree with the fact that, you know, standardization is really going to be key for long-term success. I agree. Nothing, it's not going anywhere. You know, this kind of climate play or carbon play, as you call it, is seems to pretty much be a done deal as far as it's got its foothold here. I'm really curious, you know, do you see the growth of Heartland or just, you know, the work that you do in general growing more with that carbon side or more with the agronomic side?
I see both. And that's one of the reasons that I've really appreciated, and I greatly look forward to my relationship with Earth Optics, to furthering my relationship with Earth Optics, is what Earth Optics has brought to the table in regards to the ground owl and the technology that's associated with the services that we provide. From an agronomic standpoint, you know, if I can go out there with that ground owl and I can scan that soil on 60-foot swaths And now based on that interpolation, I'll call it interpolation based off of field characteristics, you know, the historical interpolation method is either kriging or inverse relation. And that's just a computer equation that ultimately is going to take every single point, you know, kriging every single point on that map in that grid cell or in that whole field and average it against every single other point to try and come up with those transitions as to where my highs and lows are determined. What I like about Earth Optics with the ground owl is being able to scan that soil, measure the field characteristics, come up with a better than 95% probability of field characteristic to soil sample, to nutrient, and then use that in-field characteristic as my interpolation method to come up with a much more higher resolution image than I can provide with a 2.5 acre grid. And even better yet, it allows me to go out there and in some regards, I don't have to pull soil samples, but every 10 acres based off mm-hmm. of the technology that you guys have offered us. And so therefore it's going to make the labor, it's going to ease the labor pains. It's going to hopefully lessen my cost associated with servicing that acre based on the fewer soil samples. Now on 160 acres instead of 64 soil samples, all I have to send in is 16 and mm-hmm. I get a better map in return, you know? And so it's just the best of both worlds. And I've run a couple of side-by-sides just for my own sake to get my own faith in what that technology offers and what it looks like in comparison to what I've hung my hat on for the last 15 years. And it's phenomenal. And I'm very excited to move forward with it.
Yeah, I mean, you went from composite sample, one data point on a 100-acre field, to 2.5 acre grid, which has given you, what, 40-some data points on a field. And then with Earth Optics, you're taking it to 10 meter resolution, which is thousands of data points on a field. You know, maybe too many data points on a field, you know, and never enough, but really giving you that in tune. And I liked what you said about the growers always knowing, the farmers always knowing, because, man, I don't have a millionth of the experience that you do in the world of agronomy. But I know when I pull a map up with a farmer or grower that they're going to look at it. And the thing I thought was an anomaly, they go, oh, no, that's where we had this trench dug, or that's where we did, you know, X, Y, or Z, or we used to have a shed there, whatever it is, they always know exactly what.
There's some of those data sets we can't record. We never would be able to.
Yeah.
But they have that knowledge.
Yeah.
Now, Landon, you mentioned that, you know, talking to growers about kind of transitioning from composite sampling to grid sampling was actually pretty easy once you kind of broke it down. Like, look, this is kind of clearly why you need to do this. Has that been the same story when you're talking to growers or anybody in particular about kind of this, you know, emerging world of ag tech, when, you know, whether it be the ground owl sensor suite from Earth Optics or anything else that you utilize, is it a different conversation when you kind of bring technology into the mix, or is it, you know, kind of the same deal?
It always comes down to the economics, really. You know, the first, how much does it cost, you know? And as long as it's something that's reasonably affordable, and realistically, if we can get this to where I think we're going to and where we are, we should be able to come in at a very similar price point to what they're already comfortable with mm-hmm. and provide them a much better data set. You know, and working with some of the guys at Pattern Ag and with Earth Optics and the relationship that you guys have with Pattern Ag and their biological panel, and being able to go out there and perform even more of an analysis than just fertility per each soil sample and bring that additional information back to the grower to be able to determine, okay, am I going to be fighting sudden death syndrome this year? Am I going to have soybean cyst nematode? And if so, where? You know, the problem with our society as agriculture, or our industry, our portion of the industry in agriculture, is everything a farmer has always done, if you think about it, by and large is primarily reactive. Mm-hmm. With today's technology, the lab, you know, like Pattern's capabilities, the scan data, the labor, you know, that we're able to provide, be able to take that data and put it into the technology that they have on farm and help them make these decisions. Why aren't we a more proactive industry? A lot of these items, we've been doing it with fertility for a long time. Oh, you have low fertility here. So when you plant this crop, you need to apply more product. Well, when we can go out there and we can do a biological panel on this soil and be able to tell them exactly what diseases they need to prepare for and where they're going to experience those diseases in the field, that's going to help them determine what traits they need on their corn. You know, so now all of these traits, and corn seed is expensive, or wheat or whatever it is. They may be purchasing traits that are not necessary, and they're spending money like it's going out of style. And realistically, the inputs and the equipment and everything associated with the farm is so expensive today that sometimes the way farmers make money is in bushels, right? And that's what they're attuned to, is the next bushel, the next bushel. It's kind of that there's kind of a shift right now. I think there's just as much money made now in efficiencies on the farm based on cost of inputs as there is in the next bushel. And sometimes chasing that next bushel costs you as much as the first 100 bushels.
Yeah. I think when I heard 12 bucks, you know, as I mentioned, newer into the agronomy space in this kind of segment of my career, but when I heard 12 bucks an acre, I thought, dang, that's a lot of money. And it wasn't until I kind of saw the pie chart breakout of the other input per acre costs that growers and farmers are spending when I thought, man, that is a smaller piece of the pie compared to all the other things that they have going on in the operation.
I had a chart drawn out at one point in time. I don't even know where it's at. This has been years ago, but on an irrigated acre, the cost of the 2.5 acre grid soil sample, the variable rate maps, and everything that we've discussed was less than 0.1% of the overall expenditures on that farm on an annual basis.
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
But, you know, I was visiting with a guy at the fuel pump the other day. I was getting gas, and he's still farming old school the way he's always done it. He's probably in his 70s, you know, and he's one of those you're probably not going to change. We've serviced a lot of his acres, and he's had a lot of our maps run on his acres, and he's had a good experience with it. But the way he's farming, you know, it was an additional expense to what he's trying to accomplish. And, you know, he was sitting there, we were talking about it, and he says, I just don't know how in the world we're ever going to make it work. I don't know what we're going to do here, how this is going to function. And I just told him, I said, you know, it's the same game. It's just being played differently. I'm not a video gamer. I've got a 12-year-old son, and he's got an Xbox, you know, and I love analogies. And that's what I told him. I said, you know, the problem is you're trying to play the same game with an Atari like you used to, and everybody else is using Xboxes. And so, you know, you're sometimes put yourself at a disadvantage in that regard by not changing, but change is scary.
Change it. How do you think that impacts the grower or the farmer, right? Because I've heard it's great to have a 10-meter resolution, but I don't have equipment that can, you know, do variable rate application at a 10-meter grid cell. Like, there's limitations to the equipment we run across the field. Do you get that pushback from growers?
There are limitations. Yeah, that's not wrong, but they're getting better and they'll continue to get better. So are we basing our decisions moving forward off of the previous 5 years, or are we basing our decisions on what's going to happen in the next 5 years?
I like that.
I mean, you have to take both of them into consideration, obviously, but personally, I always am trying to look at the next 5 years, and sometimes getting there is expensive. A lot of times, well, just like with what we did with Farm Comp, it's finally up and rolling. I'm pretty much cash flowed it for the last 3 or 4 years, but now it's really ramped up and here we are. And so it's a matter of trying to be educated and knowledgeable enough in the industry and the ever changing industry that we live in to try and foresee as best as possible what that next move is, and not make it too soon, you know, but not make it too late. And so there's definitely a balance there.
So if you had to summarize, you know, all of these kind of exciting new technologies that are coming online and that you're trialing or pushing forward, what are you most excited about and where do you see as the opportunity for the most growth?
With Earth Optics, hands down, with the ground owl and what we discussed earlier. That's where my focus is right now. Really truly is, because I see exactly what we discussed. I see fewer soil samples being pulled. I see my labor force being much happier. I see a higher resolution image that's going to match. If the equipment doesn't match it, the equipment will match it. Let's be real. I see a lot of opportunity right there. You know, and the thing of it is too, is with the tool that you guys have brought to the table, it's scalable. Some of these other tools out here, they're just not scalable. There's no way I could go out and, you know, last year we serviced right at 800,000 acres. My goal's over 1 million this year. And there's a lot of these tools that are out here that are so, so dialed, so fine tuned that and so time consumptive, and I can't run large amounts of acres in a short time frame, that there's no way I could ever service those. It's kind of like the drones, right? When drones first came about and really took a stronghold in agriculture, let's say 10 years ago, 12 years ago, maybe, was when they really, really made their appearance. Man, they came to the industry and they came to the market like they were the save all end all. You know, we're gonna have a bird's eye view of everything. We can do this, we can do that. I got into them. I hired a guy. We created a new department in our company called our Crop Sensory Department. It's still in existence, but we no longer have any drones. And it was because I couldn't scale a drone and I didn't have the manpower, because realistically, and now drones do have their place. I'm not trying to knock them, but at that point in time for what we were trying to accomplish, I couldn't put a drone, to your point, Gunnar, under over 180,000 acres in a 2 week time frame. First of all, I didn't have the manpower, and I didn't have enough drones to do that. And so you saw the drones kind of fall off for a little while, just for the one-off opportunities. Okay, let's get a drone in the air and let's fly it. So we transitioned from drones to I just call them manned aircraft, you know, because I can put an airplane in the air and I can get 1 million acres in a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that technology is getting better. And realistically, let's not downplay satellite imagery. Satellite imagery is not going to go backwards. And it's going to be even that much more scalable.
Yep, 100%. Now, Landon, you know, we know you're a pretty busy guy, so we don't want to keep you any longer than we have to. So we're going to wrap up here with a fun question or two. And I don't know how fun this really is, but, you know, when you're not running a very successful soil sampling company, what are you doing? What takes up your free time, if you have any?
Oh, I try and make free time. You know, I found that you never have it unless you make it. And so I love to hunt and I love to fish. Huge waterfowl hunter, deer, elk, turkey. And I love to fish. My son is just as ate up with it as I am. And so that's just a great bonding opportunity for us. My entire family hunts, my wife, my daughter, everybody. Deer season's a fun time for us. Summertime, I like the lake. You know, we go to the lake every single weekend. We boat, we ski, we fish, we hang out and tell lies with our friends. And, you know, it's, that's kind of our release.
Have you heard of the ski nautique?
Yes.
My grandfather was, rumor has it, my grandfather didn't design the first one, but he built the first one. The guy
You're
came
kidding.
From the design and he put together the first one, and he skied. I grew up skiing. My mom skis. All of them. My mom said he'd send them out on sleds and discs and the whole thing. But that's the rumor in the family. Who knows if it's true.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, amazing. Thank you so much for being here, Landon. This was really a great time. I know Piper and I were both really excited to have you on, both because you're just an awesome guy to talk to, but you've got a great story. Do you have any closing remarks for us, or should we just wrap it up, call it a day?
I'll leave you with our motto, you know, unless you test, it's just a guess.
There you go. I love it. All righty. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in, and stay grounded.
Thank you guys so much for the opportunity.
Of course.